KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Salif Keita Live in Portland on Friday, March 3rd at the Dow Event Center in Portland. Salif Keita is known as the golden voice of Afropop. He combines traditional West African styles with influences from Europe and the Americas. The Spiritual Brothers will open the show. Again, that's Salif Keita Live in Portland on Friday, March 3rd at the Dow Event Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Okay, good morning, KBOO listeners. This is episode 190 of Fight the Empire. My guest is Professor Stephen Cohen, who's a professor emeritus of Russian studies at Princeton and New York University, and also a contributing editor of The Nation magazine, who has written an awful lot about Russia lately. An awful lot needs to be said. Well, thank you, Stephen Cohen, for being with us. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Well, this, I don't know when this wave of Russophobia began, but it's been going on a while. It's really, it just seems to be never ending. It keeps getting bigger and bigger. What's going on?
Well, it goes back, I think, maybe a decade, when Washington decided that Russian President Putin was the number one enemy, and then it's been driven by events. But the real surge that I guess you're referring to, that brings it to us every day in the mainstream media, was the Clinton campaign for the presidency about a year ago in mid-2016, when, for whatever reason, she, the campaign, decided to run not against Trump and Pence, but against Trump and Putin. And they began almost daily to feed this narrative that Putin, that Trump, excuse me, somehow is a Kremlin stooge, that the Kremlin hacked the Democratic National Committee and used the emails to disadvantage Mrs. Clinton and put Trump in the White House, and it's taken on a life of its own. I've never seen anything like it. I think it's unprecedented. So far, we have absolutely no facts for it. It's been driven by allegations based on anonymous sources, and as yet, no real actual facts that you and I can look at and say, yes, this incriminates Trump or it doesn't. But it's daily, especially in the New York Times, Washington Post, on cable talk, MSNBC in particular, and CNN. It's unprecedented. I don't know that I'm sure a Russian American president has never been accused of being an agent of the Kremlin. And meanwhile, we have an ever more increasing Cold War with Russia, fraught with hot war. So I think we're in new territory without precedent, and there's a lot of political disorientation, I think.
Well, one of these allegations has to do with Trump's supposed business dealings with Russia. Exactly what are they?
Well, let me begin by saying that I wrote for The Nation, and it appeared in the magazine last week, and it's on the web, thenation.com. A short article looking at the six allegations said to show that Trump is a Manchurian candidate or a Kremlin agent, or as Paul Krugman of the New York Times says repeatedly, that there is a Trump-Putin regime, as he calls it, in the White House. I looked at these six allegations briefly, you know, a paragraph or so each, and my point is that I can't tell you if a single one of them is true or not. I'm not even sure all these years later that Oswald alone killed Kennedy. There's always doubt in everything in modern life, it seems. But there's no evidence for any of this, no facts. And without facts, what do any of us do, whether we're professors or journalists or doctors or radio hosts? We need facts. We can't go around basing our policy and our lives on a rumor we hear every day. So among these allegations, which range from, excuse me, some kind of financial or sexual blackmail that the Kremlin has on Trump to his business dealings. This business dealing is fairly strange. They say that Trump and his associates have had business dealings with Russian oligarchs. This is true. But it's also true about almost every American since the end of the Soviet Union, about almost true about every American energy extracting or mineral company. Russia's an enormous source of untapped energy and minerals. It's also true of Pfizer and the Ford Motor Company and Wendy's and McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken. And they do hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of business in Russia. And most of their partners there, because of the way the Russian economy was structured after the end of the Soviet Union, are what we would call oligarchs. The only thing we know for sure about Trump, and this is kind of funny because I watched this happen, is that after the Soviet Union ended and a lot of Russians got really rich really quick and had cash, they wanted to buy quality, luxury, branded condos or co-ops, particularly in New York and in South Florida. And the only brand they'd ever heard of was Trump. So as Trump's son said once, that part of Trump Enterprises, selling real estate, had a lot of Russian money in it. And where I live briefly down in South Florida now, just north of Miami Beach in the Hollywood-Hollandale area, that area has been turned into a kind of Russian community down there. They got menus in Russian and the restaurants and all the rest. That was very legitimate business. Every major American realtor was chasing that Russian money. That, unless Trump's got something hidden in his tax returns, is all we know factually. And it's I can imagine that a lot of American corporate CEOs are nervous today with these allegations that doing business in Russia is somehow subversive. Not clear where this is headed.
Well, you know, as far as business dealings goes, the New York Times reported back in 2015 that Bill Clinton got paid $500,000 for a speech in Moscow. And it had to do with a Russian company, Rosatom, trying to acquire uranium mines around the world, including Canada and the United States.
Yeah, that was a bad business. I don't know the extent to which the reports of cause and effect, Clinton getting the money and and that uranium company being transferred, is correct. But quite a few Americans of various kinds are invited to go to Russia and give talks. I mean, we don't get $500,000 like Clinton. But sometimes it's an event that some of us, such as myself, would like to participate in. I never take a fee. I never have. And I don't even let them pay my expenses. I either go because I'm there already to this conference or I pay my own way. General Flynn, who lost his position as National Security Advisor recently, as you know, and as your listeners know, one of the charges against him was he had taken a fee to speak at a media event in Russia. You remember that?
I think so, yes.
That was where he sat at a table, a head table, where Putin was present.
That's right.
So there's this photograph of Putin and Flynn together. That's completely innocuous. I mean, completely. Lots of people, prominent Americans, have done something similar. Flynn's policy, because he was working through a speaking agent, I guess, was to take a fee. I wouldn't have done it, but, you know, maybe he needed the money. Maybe that was just the way he operated. He was a private citizen. He had every right. So you're getting all this trashy McCarthyite batches of allegations filling a media that no longer fact-checks or cares what it publishes. And that puts us in this terrible position. Now, no matter what you think of Trump, I didn't support him. I didn't vote for him. The reality is today that we're in a very perilous situation with Russia in this new Cold War. So I ask people to try to remember back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Even if we're not old enough to remember, it's taught in school as a model instance when President Kennedy resolved an existential nuclear standoff then with the Soviet Union. If something like that were to happen today, which required negotiation and compromise with Russia, with the Kremlin, Trump would be unable to do it because he would be accused of treason in these circumstances. So we're talking ourselves into a situation, perhaps, that the only way President Trump can prove he's loyal to America and not to Russia is to go to war against Russia. And that we do not want, obviously.
Well, I think back in the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy was able to resolve it by having kind of a back-channel communications with Khrushchev.
That's right. Excuse me. It's cold time up here in New York. The weather changes every day. What we know about that, and it's not just of historical interest, it's very relevant today, that Kennedy resolved that crisis by finding a way to give the Soviet leader who had precipitated it by putting the missiles into Cuba, that was Nikita Khrushchev in 1962, a face-saving way out for his own people, because Khrushchev had a politics in Moscow, just as Putin has a politics in Moscow, though we never read about it in the United States. Among the face-saving devices that Kennedy gave Khrushchev is that we had, though it wasn't well known, the same kind of missiles in Turkey, almost just as close to the Soviet Union as Cuba was to Miami Beach, so to speak. And privately, he assured Khrushchev that after a certain period of time, he, Kennedy, would remove those American missiles from Turkey. So Khrushchev could tell his people, his hardliners, we struck a fair bargain, and that was well worth the bargain. Trump could never do anything like that, because if the New York Times and MSNBC and CNN continue to allege that he's been compromised by the Kremlin, that would look like treason. That's why my mind goes back to the Cuban Missile Crisis as an example of how dangerous a situation could be today.
Let's go on to this whole hacking controversy. One thing that strikes me is that hacking is one thing and leaking is another. I'm pretty sure that they are hacking us and we are hacking them, and but that does not mean the leaks actually. According to the go-between for the leaker, it was not the Russians that gave him this information, but it was a disgruntled person in the DNC or somebody.
You don't know, and I don't know. That's where we're at. It has been said that the Democratic National Committee was hacked, which everybody knows means that they did it from afar, digitally. The hackers got into the DNC computers and stole the emails, right? That's the official story. But there are people in this country who have no liking for Putin or Trump. They are cyber experts who say this is not plausible. First of all, they say, and I don't know. I mean, I, like you, just read what experts say. It's kind of like going to the doctor. We can't diagnose ourselves, right? We go to the best doctor, and we get a second opinion. The opinion of these people is it was not a hack at all. It was a leak, meaning something like Edward Snowden. Somebody inside the DNC took the files from a computer, left, and then gave them to somebody. Maybe WikiLeaks. So the argument of the experts go is that if the Russians did it, they would not leave fingerprints. So all this talk of Russian fingerprints is a false flag, because the Russians are so good, as the United States is so good, that unless they want you to know they've been in your computer, you will never know. And in addition, they have other technical reason to think it was not a hack. Now, if it was not a hack, the hacking had nothing to do with Russia. But here we are today with each day a new story about Trump's complicity with the Kremlin, based solely on the argument that the Russian hacking of the DNC was done to put Trump in the White House. Now, leave aside the fact that there's no electoral evidence, no data, to show that the American people, who were told this every day, cared or believed it. I mean, there's no evidence that in Michigan or Wisconsin or Ohio, people went out and voted for Mrs. Clinton on the grounds that Trump was a Russian agent. That's a good sign. I don't know how it is in Portland, but where I come from, Kentucky, and secondarily from Indiana, there's no evidence that any of the voters down there gave this any electoral credibility. Now, remember, we live in a country where there's been a kind of Russia is the grave threat for decades. So you would think that any hint that Trump may be compromised by Russia would have killed him in the election. But it seemed to have had no impact at all. That's a good sign, I think.
Well, one thing that stands out to me is that the information that was leaked was true information. And it was stuff that the American people had a right to know about.
I get that. And in that sense, like you, I guess, I have mixed feelings about, quote, stealing other people's information and publicizing it. Obviously, there are cases when it is overwhelming in the national interest that we know what's going on in our name. That's my feeling about Edward Snowden, that what he did was patriotic and necessary. Let me say I may be compromised a little because my wife, Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor of The Nation, and I met with him a couple years ago when we were in Moscow and did a long interview with him, and I liked him, and I was very impressed by his sincerity. But generally, I wouldn't want anybody to hack into my private information, but I'm not a public figure. The information was true, and I think the nation needed to know what the DNC was doing against Bernie Sanders. It tells us that we need to clean up our elections. And the DNC actually says it's doing so now, so they took it to heart. But now we've got this leaking by American intelligence agencies against Trump, and this is something completely different. Progressives and liberals, whatever that means, were always against our intelligence agencies interfering in our domestic politics. And now progressives and liberals are saying that the intelligence services are doing a good thing. That's how much they loathe Trump. But we got to have some priorities. Where will this end? And we'll get some more leaks, I think. Probably. Mm-hmm. There was already one in the Washington Post yesterday that the FBI actually contracted this collector of blackmail information in London to work with it to create that so-called Trump dossier, which purported to show that the Kremlin had blackmail information on Trump. None of it has been verified. None of it whatsoever. You know, it's financial and sexual and all the rest. It's just Moscow trash. But that the FBI was working with this guy, somebody leaked that the other day. I mean, it's bad what's going on in the intelligence services.
Well, one thing that really kind of gets to me is that a lot of, you know, people I know who are progressives, liberals, they really have some kind of almost an emotional stake in believing this about the Russians. And I think it's that, you know, the American political system put Trump in the White House, and a lot of people don't want to face up to that. They'd rather blame Putin for it.
Well, that's true. But then it's absolutely true, and it's lamentable. And I wish they would stop and get onto the business of being a real opposition party instead of feeding what is really, and I don't use this word lightly, a new McCarthyism. Because it will come eventually for other people. The New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof published a column, I'm not sure where it was on the web or the print edition, on which date, but February 15th or 16th, saying that all the allegations may or may not be true, but what's really incriminating is that Trump thinks differently about Russia than has our foreign policy establishment for the last 20 years, and that's true. That's true, but so do I. I published two books criticizing American foreign policy, bipartisan foreign policy toward Russia since the end of the Soviet Union. So has President Reagan's ambassador to Moscow, the very eminent Jack Matlock. So from time to time has Henry Kissinger. Does that mean that all of us are now under suspicion? Not for something we did, but for something we've thought and written. And if so, if any deviation from the bipartisan, consensual, orthodox Washington thinking about Russia for 20 years any dissent from that is now subversion and treasonous. Everyone's in trouble, where it's now into thought control. And that leaves aside what might be the paramount issue, is American national security. What are we going to do about our relations with Russia in regard to the Baltic states and Poland, where there's really a reckless NATO buildup underway, and both sides are now rattling their missiles? Or in Ukraine, where there's a simmering civil and proxy war that could ignite into a direct American-Russian hot war at any moment. And then everybody, of course, knows about Syria, where Russian and American airplanes are still flying in approximate airspace. The potential for something really bad happening is enormous. And instead of doing anything about it, wise, diplomatically, our whole foreign policy establishment is engaged in a spreading witch hunt, looking for Russian contacts or Russian influence or Putin agents here in the United States.
Well, you know, we hear a lot about Putin as being this kind of pulling strings all over. How much democracy is there in Russia?
Well, you know, now I lapse into my role as historian. Mm-hmm. I've written the history of 20th century and 21st century Russia and taught about it at Princeton and New York University for 40 years. I ask myself, when I think about the question you asked, is there any democracy in Russia today? The question that my mentor, the late, great Robert C. Tucker, I think narration, always used to ask himself, what time is it in Russia? Because he felt that you had Russian pop in the context were on a different clock. That would mean, is there more or less democracy in Russia today under Putin than there has been in Russia prior to Putin? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
It's in Russia that you evaluate these questions, because as a wise Russian once said to me when we were discussing this some years ago, he said, Steve, look, Russia can't jump out of its skin. And that's right. So it's a long story where Putin's government stands in relationship to us. And this would just be the opening statement if we were having a seminar, let's say, of various so-called experts. There's boundlessly more freedom to travel, speak, the rest, until, let's say, the lease off, ended press censorship and ended under other constraints on Russia, much more. But arguably, there's less than there was in the early, under Gorbachev and then under Yeltsin, prior to Putin coming to power in the year 2000. So there has been a downward trajectory, I would say not of democracy, but of democratization in Russia, in the last, let's say, 10 years under Putin, downward. But nonetheless, it remains boundlessly higher than it was, let us say, approximately 25 years ago.
Well, it would seem to me that threatening war is not a very good way to encourage democracy.
Well, the history of this here has always been, and I wrote about this even before the Soviet Union ended, that the more Cold War abroad in Russia, and by the way, it happens here too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously it's much more dangerous in Russia because we have so many democratic safeguards, so much democratic space. But in Russia, there has been, and it doesn't take an analytical genius to understand why, that when Russia seems to be in danger from abroad, the political class diminishes the space for opposition and dissent at home. That reflex. So if we really care about seeing Russia become an enemy.
Well, one thing, back in the early 90s, they were plundering Russia, but it got interrupted. And so, does that make any sense?
Studying Russia, and therefore as an American, America, for, I guess, going on 50 years. And the question of why Russia always repeatedly, no matter how many collaborative episodes they are, becomes, for the American political establishment, the evil and the threat, I'm not sure. And as you say, some people trace it way back in history. There are people who think that when the pogroms occurred under the czars and so many Russian Jews came to America, and many of us are their descendants, that we brought with us a kind of anti-Russian gene. I mean, there's probably a little truth in all these things, but for our lifetime, looking back since the end of the Soviet Union, which was the great missed opportunity for a permanent new partner-like relationship with Russia. What happened was, is that what Reagan and Gorbachev, the last Soviet leader, and then the first President Bush agreed upon, is that the Cold War would end, that Soviet Russia, and then post-Soviet Russia, would become part of Western security arrangements, not the target of Western security arrangements. When that failed, or it was killed by Clinton, President Clinton, however you look at it, that was the great lost opportunity of our lives. And everybody talks about it, but I don't think people fully understand it. Clinton's decision to expand NATO eastward toward Russia, the second President Bush's decision to continue that expansion, and then Obama's decision to put NATO, right literally on Russia's borders, this military organization. That was the final death blow to this opportunity that Gorbachev, Reagan, and the first Bush gave us. So that opportunity was lost. And since then, it's just been a spiraling downward process of American-led, what appears in Moscow to be aggression toward Moscow, no matter what we think of it, and Russian reaction under Putin in particular.
Well, and now Russia seems to be looking eastward to a kind of a Eurasian economic topic for another discussion on this show. Can you say anything about
the historic, vital, essential questions? Russia has moved increasingly toward China, and not only China, other non-Western countries, as a result of the crisis that began in Ukraine in 2014 and the sanctions that followed. The question we have to ask ourselves, has Russia left the West forever, or is this still partially reversible? And that's where we stand today.
Okay, we've been talking with Stephen Cohn, who's a professor emeritus of Russian studies at New York University and Princeton University. And he's also a contributing editor of The Nation. Thank you very much for being with us, Stephen Cohn.
My thanks to you.
And I hope we get a chance to talk some more about this later. I think this is not going to go away.
It's not going away.
Okay, thank you very much.
All best.
Hey, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Coming up in 15 minutes, we've got Flashpoints today, a look at the wave of threats and attacks on Jewish cemeteries and community centers, plus an excerpt from Greg Pallas, by author of Personal Experiment. And then wrapping it up this morning, it's Black Book Talk at 11:30. Reviews, works coming up all ahead here, right now, with headlines, interviews, and commentary. Hey, thanks, KBOO members, for your generous KBOO.
KBOO, sponsor of Identities and Futures. Women and non-binary folks speak out March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Holocene in Portland. Identities and Futures is in DJs, including DJ Kim Fizzy, Lily Croft, Gene Etheridge, Push. Again, that's Identities and Futures, Women and Non-Binary Folks Speak Out, March 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Holocene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.